They told me I was crafting stories. I didn't realize I was rewriting reality. I was one of the top brand architects at the world's most powerful ad agency. Until I discovered the truth. Our ads didn't just sell products, they hijacked emotions, triggered trauma, and manipulated behavior down to the breath. We used scent, sound, memory, and data so precise, it knew what you were afraid of before you did. But when I tried to walk away, they turned me into the villain and monetized my downfall. This isn't just a story about advertising. It's about control, obsession, and the algorithm that now knows you better than you know yourself. Welcome to the story they never wanted told. Welcome to the skillful art of manipulation. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Dark Truths of Manipulation in Advertisements Exposed. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. The First Lie They Sold Me. You ever sit in a room so polished, so pristine, it feels like you're being watched even when you're alone? That was the Aurelia Global Boardroom. Walls like obsidian mirrors. Floors so white, you'd swear they were scrubbed with bleach and ambition. I used to love that room. Back then, I thought I'd made it. That being there meant something. That I was chosen. God, I was so fucking naive. I remember the first time I walked into that room like it happened 5 minutes ago. I had just been promoted to senior brand architect, fancy term for head manipulator. And I had this dumb grin on my face like a kid handed the keys to a candy store. I was 29, sharp, hungry, and more than anything, I wanted to matter. The walls were covered in backlit brand slogans etched into frosted glass. Make them need you. Emotion before logic. And the one that still haunts me. Sell the feeling, not the product. That's what we did. Hell, it's what I was praised for. Nobody cared if your product worked. Nobody gave a shit if the cream reduced wrinkles or if the shampoo really added volume. All they cared about was the feeling, the story. Could we make a housewife in Arkansas cry over a bar of soap? Could we make a teenage boy believe a sneaker would make him desirable? Spoiler alert, we could. And we did. Every damn day, I started out writing taglines. Nothing huge. Just the stuff that lives in your subconscious long enough to shape your choices. 5 words, maybe 6, that somehow stay with you longer than your mother's advice. Feel the fire. More than clean. Power in your pocket. Do those sound familiar? They should. You've seen them. Hell, you've probably repeated them without even realizing. That's me. I did that. I fucking embedded those things into your head like a hypnotist with a $1 million budget. And I was good. Too good. That's why they promoted me. That's why I got a seat at the long obsidian table. And that's when I stopped sleeping. The deeper you go into this world, the less real things start to feel. You start seeing people as targets. Not customers, targets. User segments. Emotionally susceptible demographics. You look at a single mom and think, she's 2 bad days away from buying a subscription box she doesn't need just to feel cared for. You look at a teenager and think, he'll swallow whatever we throw at him if we attach it to identity and rebellion. That first pitch meeting as senior architect was when the rot began to show. We were launching a line of neurosupplemented energy drinks. Basically, caffeine cocktails with nootropics and just enough legal ambiguity to market them as mental enhancers. Our target? Burnt out 20-somethings. Depressed grad students. Underpaid gig workers. People like me, before I sold my soul. They called it Synergize. No vowels. Because we were edgy. Disruptive. You know the type. I sat across from the head of NeuroOps, Dr. London, a man who always smelled like mint and menace. He looked me in the eye, slid a dossier across the table, and said, I want them addicted. Not chemically. Psychologically. Make them crave the identity it give them. I should have said no, but I didn't. Instead, I nodded, took the dossier, and smiled like a loyal little soldier. I remember going back to my office that night and staring at the screen for 3 hours. I didn't write a word. I just sat there thinking about how easily I had said yes, how quickly my spine folded, And then I told myself something I'd repeat for years to come. It's just advertising. Everyone does it. You're not hurting anyone. That was the first lie I sold myself. The next day, I wrote the line, "Synergize. Wake up to who you were meant to be." Sounds innocent, right? Inspirational even. But here's what it really meant. What we knew, what we calculated in every test group. Wake up triggers urgency and inadequacy. Who you were meant to be hijacks personal dissatisfaction. The whole line weaponizes identity crises and existential dread. We didn't sell energy drinks. We sold transformation. We sold hope in a can. We just didn't give a fuck if it worked, only that they bought it again. The first campaign ran for 6 months. In that time, sales tripled. But so did ER visits for anxiety-related symptoms. Nobody connected the dots, not even the victims. Just a spike in heart rates. A rise in panic. A few cases of psychosis here and there. But hey, our ROI was through the roof, and we won an Effie. I should have stopped then. Walked away. Burned it all down. But by then, I was part of it. Deep in the machinery. I had bonuses. A luxury apartment. A weekly four drip of compliments and catered sushi. And a tiny, whispering voice in my head that said, "If you don't do it, someone else will." So I stayed. And I kept writing. And I started losing parts of myself. First it was my mornings. I'd wake up exhausted, even if I'd slept. Then my appetite. Then friends stopped inviting me to things because I'd always find a way to make conversations about branding. How everything was a narrative, a sell, a play for control. I didn't realize until much later what had really happened. The first lie they sold me wasn't about a product. It was about power. They told me I had it. They told me I could shape reality. But I was never in control. I was just another fucking ad. And by the time I realized it, the damage was already done. Chapter 2. The Focus Group from Hell. There are rooms that are built to break people. You'd think they'd look like interrogation chambers or prison cells, right? Nope. This one had pastel walls, comfy chairs, soft jazz playing under a fake skylight. It was a focus group room at Aurelia Global. Behind a two-way mirror, I sat in the observation booth with my creative director, one of the brand psychologists, and a fucking empathy strategist, a guy whose job it was to tell us how feelings work like we didn't already know how to manipulate them. We were watching seven participants, diverse, beautiful, and broken in different ways, watch a new ad we'd just produced for Luster. A perfume line inspired by trauma. Yes, you heard that right. We were selling pain now. Bottled it. Branded it. Gave it a velvet box. The ad itself was a slow, emotional burn. A little girl watches her mother vanish behind a closing elevator door. Cut to years later. She finds a bottle of perfume in her mother's drawer. One whiff, and the girl, now grown, is flooded with memories. Tears. Resolution. Peace. Final tagline? Luster. Remember who you were before the silence. And then, fade to black. We watch the participants through tinted glass. Heart monitors. Eye tracking. Micro-expression analysis. It wasn't a test group. It was fucking surveillance with snacks. At first, the reactions were exactly what we wanted. The woman in seat 3 clutched her chest. The man in seat 5 wiped a tear. One woman whispered, "That's exactly how I felt when my mom left." Bullseye. But then, seat 7, the kid. Youngest in the room. Barely 12. She was the daughter of one of our junior data engineers, brought in for the teen segment. She hadn't said a word during pre-roll discussions. Just sat there fiddling with the zipper on her hoodie, biting the inside of her cheek. Silent. Watchful. And then, right as the narrator in the ad whispered, "Your scent is your story," she started to cry. Not a delicate, tear-down-the-cheek cry. No, this was sobbing. Shoulders shaking. Breathing shallow. Eyes darting toward the door. And that's when I realized what we'd done. That perfume? That fake story? It wasn't fake to her. It triggered something real. Raw. Maybe something she hadn't even processed yet. But we had. We had designed it to. The empathy strategist leaned forward and said, "This is gold. Raw emotional transference. We should double down on that copy angle. Double down. The girl was breaking, and this asshole wanted to put it in the pitch deck like it was a TikTok trend. Maybe we should pause, I muttered, shifting uncomfortably. My creative director didn't even look up from her tablet. Are you kidding? This is the most authentic response we've had all quarter. Authentic. Jesus. Everything started to spin a little. Because in that moment, I remembered something I hadn't thought about in years. My sister, crying like that in our shared room after our dad left. The sound of her gasping, trying not to be heard. I remembered how helpless I'd felt. And now here I was. A grown-ass man. A well-paid brand architect. Sitting behind a mirror and watching a child relive her trauma for metrics. This wasn't advertising. This was fucking emotional burglary. I stood up. We can't use this. What? Said my director, clearly irritated. We can't. Not like this. This girl's in distress. She's not giving you insight. She's reliving something real. You're exploiting her. There was a beat of silence. Then Dr. Rowan, our brand psychologist, said something I'll never forget. All memory is emotional. If it triggers recall, it's effective. That's the point, isn't it? I swear I almost lunged at him. But instead, I just left. Walked out. Stormed past the glass corridors and the marble elevator bays. Out into the cold air. Lit a cigarette for the first time in 2 years, hands shaking like I'd seen a ghost. And, in a way, I had. Not the girl. Me. I saw myself, who I had become. Someone who watched suffering like it was content. Who manufactured it. Bottled it in 30-second spots. Turned pain into purchase. That night, I went home and opened every ad I had ever written. Every script. Every pitch. I read them like confessionals. And it hit me. Our ads didn't just reflect trauma. They amplified it. Echoed it. Called it by name. I remembered a campaign we did for a dating app. The whole thing was built around the line. You deserve to be seen. Sounds empowering, right? But we weren't targeting confidence. We were targeting abandonment issues. Our user data showed that people who had recently been ghosted or experienced a parental rift were 34% more likely to click on emotionally resonant copy. Another campaign, this one for a wellness tea, used the tagline, "What if you're not the problem?" It spiked among women recovering from emotionally abusive relationships. We knew that. We banked on it. And now, watching that girl fall apart in real time, I couldn't hide from it anymore. We weren't just selling products. We were scripting wounds, profiting off memory, playing puppeteer with people's pain. The next day, I came back in. I tried to raise concerns. HR told me they'd review the footage and thank me for caring. That's what they do, by the way. They don't silence you. They document you. Make you feel heard while they quietly label you a disruption to culture. The ad launched 2 weeks later, with no changes. The girl's segment made it into the final campaign brief. They labeled her response authentic engagement and gave her a $100 Amazon card for her time. I never saw her again, but I kept seeing her. In my dreams, in train stations, in reflections that weren't mine, and worst of all, on my goddamn screen. While Luster sales spiked 213% in one quarter. They made her a ghost, and I helped write the seance. Chapter 3, Manufactured Desires. We don't sell products. We sell permission to want what you were taught to deny. They say the road to hell is paved with good intentions, but I think it's paved with taglines. Short, sharp, market-tested, polished to perfection. Then rolled out across continents to create the illusion of desire. And I was one of the best at it. But I didn't understand the real cost until I wrote the line that ended marriage. Let me tell you how it happened. We were pitching a high-end jewelry client, Valeria and Sons. Legacy brand. Declining relevance. Their problem? Young people weren't buying anymore. Jewelry doesn't mean anything to millennials, their VP of sales complained. They'd rather spend $500 on therapy or a trip to Iceland than a gold bracelet. And that's when the account director turned to me. We need something bold. Something that says, fuck tradition. A statement. So I did what I always did. I crafted a fantasy, a narrative with enough venom and sparkle to cut straight through the guilt. Because you're worth more than him. 5 words. That's all it took. The client loved it. Ate it up like caviar. They clapped in the pitch meeting. Said it was revolutionary. A call to empowerment. One even said it gave her chills. We rolled out the campaign with influencers. Women draped in gold, lips parted, eyes smoldering. No men in sight. Just freedom. Possession. Independence. The tagline pulsed on screens, billboards, YouTube pre-rolls, even Tinder. It worked. Better than anyone expected. Sales skyrocketed. Engagement surged. The campaign was dubbed a feminist reclamation of value. Except it wasn't. Not really. You see, what we actually tapped into, what we calculated, was resentment, loneliness, betrayal. We knew exactly what buttons we were pushing. Women in rocky relationships. Women who felt invisible. Women who were waiting for a sign, for permission to leave, or to prove they didn't need anyone at all. And we gave it to them. Not because we cared, but because it sold shit. I found out about the divorce in the weirdest way. A month after launch, I got an email from the agency's general inbox. The subject line was, "Your campaign destroyed my life." I clicked it, expecting a troll. It wasn't. It was from a man. Let's call him Eric. He wrote, "My wife saw your ad. She said it spoke to her. Said she realized she was tired of being less than. That she deserved more. We'd been together for 8 years. She left 2 weeks later. No warning. Just packed her things. I found the receipt for the bracelet tucked in the mirror of her vanity. With your line printed in the gift box. You sold her the idea that I was her problem. You sold her freedom and made me the cage. I sat there reading it over and over again. My fingers hovered above the keys. I thought about replying. But what the fuck was I supposed to say? Sorry, I psychologically hijacked your marriage? No one talks about this part of advertising. The aftermath. The unintended consequences, or worse, the very intended ones we pretend not to see. We sell breakups. We sell defiance. We sell fuck you money disguised as self-worth. And behind it all, there's this dirty little secret we all pretend isn't there. Most marketing isn't about aspiration. It's about inadequacy. We don't tell people what they want. We tell them what's missing. Confidence? That's code for you feel small. Luxury? That's you don't feel seen. Freedom? That's you feel trapped. I started noticing it everywhere after that. At the gym, women wore leggings branded with phrases like "own yourself," made by companies owned by men who ran sweatshops. At cafes, I overheard 20-somethings say things like, "I got this candle because it's like healing energy." Even the therapists I knew were subtly marketing themselves online with trauma-themed content. "Are you dating a narcissist?" Signs you're addicted to emotionally unavailable men. I wasn't the only one manufacturing desire. The entire world was built on it. But we at Aurelia Global were the architects. We built ad campaigns like war rooms. Segmented by income, gender, childhood wound types. Ran shadow experiments on what font was more triggering. Tracked what colors made people feel nostalgic, envious, desperate. Pushed late-night campaigns for self-care products to single women who had spent more than 6 hours alone that week. And if a product didn't work, didn't matter. We'd sell the feeling, the illusion, the dopamine drip. Once, we ran a study testing how long the post-purchase glow lasted after someone bought one of our sponsored luxury items. Average? 4 hours. That's how long the high lasted before the void returned. So what did we do? We started bundling ads, retargeting, sending follow-ups. Because you don't treat the wound. You keep poking it so they keep coming back. And here's the real fucked up part. We didn't even have to lie. We just exaggerated. We curated. We told people the things they already suspected about themselves and made them believe the solution was something they could buy. By this point in my career, I had written over 800 ad scripts. Some of them went viral. Others quietly burrowed their way into hearts and homes like termites under polished wood. but that one line, because you're worth more than him. That was the one that broke me. Because Eric wasn't wrong. I did sell his wife a fantasy. I gave her a clean, empowering narrative to attach her pain to. I gave her a villain. I just never thought that villain would be him. Or that she'd throw away 8 years of something real because of 5 emotionally charged words I scribbled at midnight on a whiteboard after 2 espressos and a Spotify playlist called Rebel Female. They gave me a bonus that quarter. Sent me champagne. My creative director called me a brand whisperer. Said I was rewriting the rules. And maybe I was. But I couldn't shake the feeling that I was also rewriting people's lives, and not in a good way. Every ad I wrote from that point on felt like a loaded gun. Every line, a calculated bullet. And slowly, I started seeing what we were doing for what it really was. Not storytelling. Not branding. Not influencing. We were rewriting reality. One desire at a time. Chapter 4. Brand cults and chemical hooks. You think brands are just products? Just logos and slogans? Nah. Brands are religions. And we weren't marketers. We were priests. We delivered rituals. We created belief systems. We didn't just sell you things. We rewired your sense of self. It started with something called scent anchoring. Back when I first joined Aurelia Global, I was invited to a hush-hush innovation lab on the 47th floor of our New York tower. No cameras. No phones. You had to sign a 10-page NDA before you even got off the elevator. Inside, the lights were low. The walls pulsed gently with ambient lighting synced to biometric sensors. And in the center of the room was this thing that looked like a high-end espresso machine crossed with a humidifier and a torture device. It was called the pulse reactor. Smell is the only sense directly wired to memory, the lab tech explained, grinning like a magician about to pull a rabbit out of someone's trauma. If you want them to feel something deeply, love, safety, desire, grief, you anchor it to scent. And you anchor scent to product. We watched a volunteer enter the room and sit in a recliner. She was calm, relaxed. Then they started the demo. First, they showed her a childhood photo. Her eyes softened. She smiled. Then, while she was flooded with nostalgia, the pulse reactor emitted a soft lavender and amber scent blend. She inhaled without realizing. Then, cut to product, a branded lotion. The same scent. Fast forward 30 minutes, and she's crying while rubbing that lotion on her hands. Not because of what it is, because of what it reminded her of. Emotional pairing, they called it. We used it to launch everything, perfumes, skin creams, room sprays. You ever wonder why certain stores always smell the same? It's not by accident. That scent is a trigger. A breadcrumb trail, a chemical leash, and the tech wasn't limited to scent. Oh no, that was just the entry drug. Next came sonic branding. We hired ex-NASA sound engineers, neurologists, former cult deprogrammers. I'm not kidding. They built sound frequencies that could make people feel uplifted, grounded, sexually aroused, or anxious, just enough to create a need for comfort. One project we worked on, a luxury vodka brand. We embedded subaudible frequencies into their club ads, waves that mimicked the heartbeat of a person during sex. People didn't hear it, but they felt it. Sales jumped 300% in nightclubs within the first week. We didn't sell vodka. We sold seduction. In a glass. Under neon. On loop. Another campaign we designed involved binaural manipulation. 2 slightly different tones played into each ear to create a brainwave illusion. We tested it on a sleep aid app. Users didn't just fall asleep faster. They dreamed about the brand. Let that sink in. They dreamed about the brand. We started calling it Second Screen Inception. Trademarked it even. Because that's what it was. An invasion into your subconscious. And then, there was the cult stuff. We didn't call it that, of course. Internally, we referred to it as brand communion. Here's how it worked. We took a mid-tier athletic apparel company, one that was struggling to compete with the big dogs, and we rebranded them as a movement. We hired sociologists, anthropologists, former military strategists, First step? Create language. Not customers. Members. Not purchases. Investments. Not ads. Manifestos. Then we curated shared rituals, wearing the gear during sunrise runs. Daily affirmations. Exclusive merch drops for believers. We told people they weren't buying leggings. They were joining a tribe. By the end of Q2, we had 6.3 million new members. And the best part? They marketed for us. Unpaid. Relentless. Evangelical. I saw women get tattoos of a logo. Saw people break friendships over who had access to the latest release. Saw influencers cry on live streams when the brand sent them personalized letters, written by me, pretending to be a faceless guardian of their personal evolution. That's when I started calling it what it really was, brand worship. You think I'm being dramatic? Here's what people don't understand. When you're lost, you don't just look for something to believe in, you look for something that makes you feel like believing matters. And we gave it to them. We watched mental health stats rise and spun it into campaigns. We took loneliness and sold community. We took anxiety and sold ritual. We took generational disillusionment and sold identity. And the hooks? They were chemical, emotional, frequencies and scents and stories engineered to tap into wounds older than memory. At one point, we worked with a vitamin brand that literally embedded scent-infused packaging and partnered with Spotify to sync ads to your heart rate. If your BPM rose, the voice would slow down. If you got too calm, it would speed up, urge you toward action. We created ads that adapted to your mood in real time. That's not marketing. That's fucking psychological warfare. I asked one of the lab directors once, "Don't you ever worry we're playing God?" She just smiled and said, "God didn't get this level of engagement." And here's the twisted part. After a while, it started to work on us, too. I found myself using the brands we designed, wearing the fragrances I once ridiculed, repeating mantras I wrote for fitness junkies even though I hadn't seen a gym in 6 months. It didn't matter that I knew. Didn't matter that I was behind the curtain. The hooks were in me now. I started to feel like a fucking puppet. A walking brand loop. My life narrated in 30-second copy blocks with a curated soundtrack and signature scent. And one night, I broke down. Alone in my apartment, I stood in the bathroom, clutching a moisturizer we'd launched for skin transformation journeys. And I asked myself, do I even know who I am anymore? Or am I just one of my own creations? That's when it hit me. I wasn't working for the brand. I was the brand. We all were. Consumers. Creators. Curators. We weren't just being sold to. We were being shaped. We had built an ecosystem so immersive, so invasive, that there was no outside anymore. No space where the brand didn't follow. Not even sleep. Not even thought. And once you realize that, there's no going back. Chapter 5. Cancel Me Softly. They didn't fire me. They erased me, rebranded me into a cautionary tale with a trending hashtag. It didn't happen all at once. That's the lie they tell you, that being canceled is this sudden, fiery explosion. One wrong tweet, one bad take, boom, career over. Nah, that's not how it works in the real world. Not when the corporations are the ones pulling the strings behind the mob. My cancellation was a slow, curated rollout. Planned. Timed. Packaged. But let me back up. At this point, I'd already been spiraling. After the scent labs, the emotional pairing experiments, the sonic branding, after everything I'd witnessed, created, enabled, I started speaking up more. Not publicly. Not yet. Just inside. Internal emails. Project meetings. A raised eyebrow here, a maybe we shouldn't there. At first, they brushed it off. Called me passionate, said I was connected to the soul of the work, that I had moral nuance. But then I started pushing harder. I questioned a campaign targeting recently bereaved spouses with memory candles scented like their dead partner's cologne. I refused to write the copy for a pill subscription that used user browsing history to predict when someone was vulnerable enough to upgrade to premium. And one day, I snapped during a creative call. we were launching a new sleep drink called Silns. Again, no vowels, because that was the aesthetic. The strategy was to use late-night doom-scrolling triggers and soft-voiced, AI-generated ads that whispered things like, "Still awake? You don't have to be. You deserve peace, even if he didn't give it to you." I said it was psychological predation, that we were manipulating insomnia caused by trauma just to sell a drink made with synthetic melatonin and rose extract. My CD didn't flinch. She looked me dead in the eye and said, "People are already suffering. At least we're offering them something." That was the day I knew I had to get out. But leaving this industry, it's not like quitting a job. It's like defecting from a cult. You don't just walk out. You get excommunicated. The day I submitted my resignation, my key card stopped working. My email was suspended within the hour. I expected that. What I didn't expect was what happened the next morning. I woke up to over 300 notifications. Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, even fucking Reddit. People were tagging me, dragging me, quoting fake messages I supposedly wrote. Screenshots I'd never seen. Comments ripped out of context, or maybe even generated, for all I know. A new post had gone viral. It was titled, "Ex-brand exec who manipulated grief for profit speaks out, and it's worse than you think." Attached was a thread full of leaked internal emails. Some real, most fabricated, detailing the most morally bankrupt campaigns I'd ever worked on. Campaigns that were approved by the C-suite, but now apparently they were my idea alone. They made me the fall guy. No official company statement. No lawsuit. No denial. Just silence. And a growing digital inferno. Within 48 hours, I was being labeled the mind molester, trauma architect, the guy who made kids cry for clicks. And you know the worst part? It worked. People ate it up, shared it, quoted it, stitched it into 60-second rants, reaction videos, think pieces. Some defended me briefly. But those voices were drowned in the algorithm's preference for outrage. Because here's the dirty truth. Cancel culture is a brand tool now. It's not about accountability. It's not even about justice. It's a feature of the system, not a bug. When a company needs to shift blame, reset public sentiment, or launch a new campaign with built-in controversy, they find a scapegoat. Someone expendable. Someone already cracking. Someone like me. And then they launch the machine. They hire PR firms to plant leaks. Push influencer discourse through DMs and brand partnerships. Seed phrases into trending conversations. Remember what he did? He never apologized. He just wants a comeback. It's brilliant, really. They turned my breakdown into a branding opportunity. Within a week of my public shaming, Aurelia launched a new internal initiative, Conscious Creative, a program promoting ethical advertising, emotional integrity, and purpose-driven narratives. They even launched a scholarship, named it after a fictional whistleblower. Not me. Never me. I was erased, replaced, rebranded. And you want to hear something really fucking twisted? Their Conscious Creative ads used my voice. They took my old keynote speech, chopped it up with AI, and repurposed it to promote their new agenda. My voice. My words. Used against me. That's when I knew this wasn't just about ads. It was about narrative control. They didn't just own the message. They owned the villain. And they made sure it looked like me. They turned me into a moral anchor, a counterexample, a parable. Don't be like him. Look how far we've come. We're better now. And behind the scenes, same execs, same tactics, same algorithms, same fucking scent labs. But now, with a fresh coat of purpose paint and a slick new slogan, feel something real. I stayed off the grid for a while after that. Deleted socials. Moved out of the city. Started sleeping with a white noise machine to block out my own thoughts. But I couldn't silence the echo, because they didn't just cancel me publicly. They infected my private life, too. Old friends stopped responding. Recruiters ghosted me. My rent application got denied, twice. When I asked why, the guy behind the desk leaned in and whispered, "Google's a bitch, man." I wasn't a person anymore. I was a search result. A curated digital profile sculpted by a multi-billion dollar brand engine to make sure no one ever believed me again. And the most fucked up part? People thanked them for it, applauded the company's growth, retweeted their apologies, donated to the scholarship. Meanwhile, I was living in a sublet room with a mattress on the floor and panic attacks that hit like freight trains. That's when I realized cancellation isn't destruction. It's commodification. They didn't kill my reputation. They monetized it. I became the villain in their redemption arc. A clickbait cautionary tale. A perfect, bite-sized brand narrative that fit in a TikTok, a podcast blurb, a YouTube essay. And when the wave finally died down, they launched a new campaign. Something about second chances, healing, empathy. And they used a new face. A young copywriter. Bright eyes. Soft smile. A carefully curated survivor of brand trauma. I recognized the look in her eyes. It was me. Before I learned what this machine really does. Before I knew that one day, it would eat me alive. And smile doing it. Chapter 6. The algorithm knows me better. I thought I was studying them. Turns out, I was the one under observation the whole damn time. It started with a whisper. Not from a person. Not from a screen. From inside me. A hunch. A flicker. A suspicion so small I almost ignored it. But once you hear it, you can't unhear it. You know the one I'm talking about. That moment when your phone shows you an ad for something you never said out loud, but thought. Just a flicker of desire. And somehow, it's there, waiting for you like it already knew. I used to laugh when people said that. Your phone's listening. I'd nod, smile politely, say, technically no. But your behavior is predictable enough to feel like it is. I should have known better. I built the fucking system. And it was never just about predicting. It was about pre-creating, controlling desire before you even knew it existed. After they canceled me, I disappeared. Thought I was off-grid. Rented a room under a fake name, disabled location services, factory, reset my devices. I thought if I stepped away, I'd be free. But it followed me. The algorithm. The ghost I helped give birth to. It started small. First, Spotify served me a playlist called Songs to Unpack Regret. Then YouTube auto-played a video essay on how brands manipulate your identity. Instagram, despite me not following anyone, slid in ads for healing retreats for emotionally exiled professionals. The kicker? One ad showed a man standing alone in a field, face shadowed, arms outstretched. The tagline, he forgave himself. You can too. I'd never searched for therapy. Never typed the words guilt, exile, or cancel culture. But somehow it knew. It always fucking knew. At first, I tried to rationalize it. My IP address. Geolocation pings. Behavior patterns. Digital exhaust. But that didn't explain how precise it got. It was like it knew not just what I was doing, but why. Then I remember the meeting. 2 years back. Private conference room. No recording allowed. Aurelia had just acquired a sentiment mapping company called SenseNest. They claimed they could predict consumer emotions 48 hours in advance. How? I asked. The product director, this smug dude named Emery, leaned back and said, simple. We've collected enough behavioral data to build an emotional shadow of every user. Not just what they do, but what they're afraid of, what they repress, what they're on the verge of doing. He called it pre-guilt mapping. We can target people before the impulse hits. Before the crisis. Before the sin. Everyone clapped. I laughed. I thought it was bullshit. But now, sitting in a half-lit room with no accounts, no history, and ads that still read me like scripture, I knew. It wasn't bullshit. It was surveillance theology. The algorithm doesn't just track your actions. It tracks your hesitations. Your late-night scrolling. How long you pause on a post. The tilt of your phone. The way your pupils dilate when you hover over an image. The slight tremor in your fingers as you scroll past an ex's photo without liking it. It knows when you're lonely. Knows when you're desperate. Knows when you're horny, hungry, grieving, or numb. And it doesn't just respond. It orchestrates. One night, I tested it. I left my phone unlocked, sat still, didn't touch anything for an hour, just stared, let my mind wander to places I hadn't let it go in a while. My father, the things I never said to him, the silence between us. Next morning, I opened YouTube. First recommendation, a TED talk titled, When Our Fathers Are Still Living Inside Us. Coincidence? Maybe. But then came the ads for books on intergenerational trauma. The podcast titled The Silence We Inherit. A Spotify ad narrated by a warm male voice whispering, You can still find peace, even if he's gone. I nearly smashed my phone. This wasn't marketing. This was fucking emotional surveillance. And that's when it hit me. The algorithm doesn't just follow you. It becomes you. It builds a digital replica. Your echo, based on everything you've ever liked, hovered on, skipped, bookmarked, replayed, cried over, almost clicked but didn't. It maps the shape of your fear, the architecture of your shame. And then it feeds you things that feel like salvation, but are just loops, ad-laced traps, packages of comfort designed to deepen your dependence. I learned about a feature we had prototyped called Mood Resonance AI. It used voice inflection and breathing patterns from smart speakers to detect mood changes. If your voice cracked when you said, Alexa, play some music, it would cue up tracks that gently nudged you toward nostalgia or catharsis, just enough to keep you emotionally open for ad impressions. We had another one called Ego Fracture Response. If you failed at something, lost a job, got dumped, bombed a creative pitch, the algorithm would trigger a cascade of ego-rebuilding ads. Luxury that reminds you who you are. Prove them wrong. You're not done yet. And people thought they were making empowered choices. They weren't. They were being coaxed into emotional rehab programs, disguised as consumption. I watched my own descent in third person. Caught myself typing out affirmations I didn't believe. Saving posts from brand coaches offering purpose strategies. Considering $399 workshops with titles like Your Next Chapter Begins Today. I stopped, hands trembling. I knew what was happening. I was becoming a user again. A node in the system I helped build. A man staring at his own reflection in the dark glass of a screen that already knew what he'd do next. I stared at my camera one night, just stared. No expression. No motion. Just wondering. I whispered, What do you want from me? The light blinked. And the next day, I got an ad. A sleek, silent one. No music. Just text on black. We don't want anything. We already have it. That's when I finally understood. The algorithm doesn't care about you. It is you. Just the version that's more pliable, more predictable, more profitable. And now that version. It's out there, living without me. Making choices. Shaping stories. Selling solutions to problems I haven't even had yet. And all I can do now is wait for the moment when it stops needing the original. Chapter 7, Truth in the Fine Print. Buried in every system is a sentence no one was ever meant to read. I found mine, and it changed everything. You ever wake up in a cold sweat and not know if you're dreaming or remembering? That's how this started. A single word etched in my mind like it had been burned there. Clause. I couldn't explain it. Couldn't trace it to any specific memory. It wasn't part of a dream, not really. It just showed up, like the system had hiccuped and whispered it into my skull during REM sleep. One glitch, one leak, one crack in the firewall of my own damn brain. Clause. I sat up, drenched in sweat. 3:17 a.m. No sound outside but the hum of distant traffic. My phone, face down on the floor, vibrated once. I picked it up. A push notification from a cloud service I hadn't used in 2 years. Final access to legacy documents expiring in 24 hours. I don't remember saving anything to that server. But the name, Vault Drop, rang a bell. Suddenly, I was shaking. Not from fear. From instinct. From knowing. Somewhere inside that archive. Somewhere under thousands of forgotten decks, pitches, and prototypes was the truth I wasn't supposed to see. It took me 14 hours straight. No food. No breaks. Just page after page, doc after doc, contract after contract. I was searching for one thing, the origin clause. You see, every product, every brand, every campaign we built at Aurelia Global started with what we call the base script. It was a universal internal agreement that defined what the brand stood for, not to the public, but to us. A creative Bible hidden beneath NDA layers, marketing euphemisms, and psychological algorithms. It was protected by legal fog, but there was a loophole. Back when I was still considered a brand architect, I had signed a full access clearance to Baseframe underscore 1.0, our earliest content development prototype. It was old, deprecated, buried under new systems. And that's where I found it, a PDF titled Core Emotional Positioning, phase 0/UTH_access_red. No one was supposed to keep it. No one was supposed to open it. But I did. And right there, on line 346, in 6-point gray text, hidden in a sea of corporate jargon and user segmentation tables, was the line that broke me. Client reserves the right to modify public behavior through suggestion, indirect, or implied. That was it. No fanfare. No glowing red letters. Just a sentence. Hidden like malware. Plain as a sigh. Read it again. Modify public behavior. This wasn't about advertising. It never was. It was about behavioral conditioning. About reprogramming the way we think, feel, move, desire. And we had agreed to it. Not just as employees, but as participants in the system. Our apps. Our assistants. Our wearables. Our voices, clicks, breathing patterns, time spent hovering over an image. We fed it all to a machine that wasn't just measuring us. It was writing us. Crafting versions of us more predictable than the originals. I sat there, stunned. Frozen. My own breath felt foreign. I remembered the perfume ads. The grief-triggering campaigns. The binaural tones. The AI-generated voices speaking in frequencies your conscious mind can't even hear. We weren't marketing to people. We were writing scripts for them to unknowingly follow. And those who resisted, they were rebranded as glitches, flaws in the system, emotional outliers. I was one of them now. That's why they had to erase me. Not to punish me. To protect the integrity of the narrative. Because I knew too much. Because I'd seen the script. And now, I had proof. I downloaded the file, printed it, held it in my hand like a holy relic dipped in poison. I considered leaking it, sending it to whistleblower networks, dumping it on Reddit, dropping it anonymously into the laps of journalists who still had spines. But then I hesitated, not out of fear, out of certainty, because I knew exactly what would happen. The story would hit. It would trend. It would spark outrage. For a moment. Then, like everything else in the age of algorithmic saturation, it would be neutralized. Fact-checked to death. Over-explained. Spun into conspiracy. Debated by influencers. Meme-ified. Turned into a docuseries. And then repackaged as a new campaign. Something like, you deserve the truth. Join the transparency movement. Powered by Aurelia. They would own it, even the rebellion, and I would be recast again, not as a whistleblower, not as a prophet, but as part of the story. Another character in a drama no one realized was scripted. I laughed, a deep, empty, exhausted laugh that hurt my ribs. Then I burned the printout, sat in silence, watched the ashes drift like digital confetti, and I made a decision. If they wanted to erase me, fine. But I'd erase myself first, on my own terms. I deleted every backup, scrubbed the cloud, smashed the phone, tore out the microphones, packed a duffel with nothing but basics and cash. I vanished, not as a victim, not as a fugitive, but as a man who no longer consented to the story. Because if everything is a narrative, then refusing to play the part is the last radical act. Now, I live in a cabin upstate. No Wi-Fi. No apps. The silence hums like a forgotten frequency. And still, sometimes, in the middle of the night, I feel it watching. Not through a screen. Not through sound. Through memory. Because even though I burned the paper, even though I vanished from the grid, That sentence, line 346, still lives inside me, etched into the folds of my cognition like a virus. Client reserves the right to modify public behavior through suggestion, indirect, or implied. And the worst part? It's not just them anymore. It's everywhere. In the words we repeat without thinking. In the choices we think we made freely. In the dreams that don't even feel like ours anymore. We thought we were consuming content, but we were being consumed. And now that you know, ask yourself one thing. Did you choose to listen to this? Or were you already written to?